Kristen Bry, day two. Made it through day one, day two.
Run it back. Do it again.
Run it back. This is the thing about a daily show. You got to get up and you got to do it again. All right. Well, with me today is my very first guest co-host, who is a Wisconsin native, a bearded American, a Democratic campaign veteran, a business owner, coach, nerd, Democratic strategist, whatever that means, man of many titles, but most importantly, a good friend of mine, a good friend of this show for as long as that has been on the air, my friend, Joe Sopecki.
Thanks for having me. This might be the greatest radio show I've ever been a part of.
That is saying a lot, because you've been on a lot of shows before, including Mr. Brian Kelly, who's sitting in the producer chair this morning.
I think we forgot occasional guest devil.
Oh, is that your, what you're referred to as? Is that what all pretend, like I wasn't not, when I covered for Devil's Radio, I was not referred to as a guest devil. I would have liked that.
Well, we all knew you were a guest devil inside.
That's fair.
Co-devil, guest co-devil. There's a lot of titles. You know what? It doesn't matter. I'm here. I'm ready to rock. Let's do this.
So one of the features of this show, which I'm excited about, is being able to bring in friends and acquaintances and people in my network to spice it up and go through the headlines with me, because, you know, people have different opinions than I do, and getting to hear those and getting those different perspectives is important. So on the first topic, to just jump into it, very excited to hear your thoughts on this one, because the biggest, the biggest political news in Wisconsin that dropped yesterday is that the warrior conservative, the political outsider, the self-proclaimed enemy of the Madison machine, Kevin Nicholson, has called it quits in his race to become governor. And his statement said, "Over the past week, I have assessed the state of the primary race and has become clear to me and my team the only path forward for our campaign is attacking the other candidates in the race on the airwaves and running a very negative campaign." And then he goes on to say something about, "We have the capability to do that, but we don't want to do that." And it's about a month, 5 weeks from the primary. He was polling at about 10%.
Here's the thing. This election has already started. Anyone who requested early enough an absentee mail-in ballot, like Kevin Nicholson's name is on the ballot. People are looking at these things in their homes today. And he goes, "Oh, just kidding."
Yeah, that is interesting. He dropped out before or after the ballots went out.
This is a very late dropout.
So what do you think, he still gets votes then?
Oh, of course he will. Yeah. And that's
so fine. That in itself strategic to do it after the absentee ballots went out?
I don't think that was probably the well thought out part of this departure from the race, but it's just a weird oddity, right? He could have read the writing on the wall 3 weeks ago and gotten out, and the ballots were still already going to be printed, right? They get printed pretty quickly after the Wisconsin Elections Commission approves your signatures. You know, there was the challenge to the Michaels campaign's signatures. And then once all that stuff is gone through, then they get, okay, go print the ballots. It takes some time. So he was probably going to be on the ballot anyways. I just think it's kind of funny that the ballots are in people's hands and people are voting in this election. And now he goes, no, just kidding. Don't vote for me.
Will his name be on the ballot in August when people vote in person, or will they print new ballots?
Yeah. No, it's the same ballot. They print them all and then they mail some out and then they put them under lock and key for distribution to all of the places we vote.
All right. So I find it interesting that his reason that he's dropping out.
The stated reason
he's dropping out is because he didn't want to go negative against other politicians, other Republicans, which is, I guess, if it was true, somewhat noble for the cause. It didn't seem like that was true, because everything I know is that at least him and one other candidate absolutely despise each other. And so I think the willingness to go low, had it been there been a clearer path to victory, would have been not a problem.
Listen, there's text and there's subtext in a case like this. And this is where I get to, you know, nerd out because I've been doing this for more than 20 years. It's one thing to say, I don't want to go negative. But then you remember, he's been going negative like every day of the race, railing against the Madison machine. He's talking about Rebecca Clayfish. So there's
and
what he
Voss
says.
And all, yeah, right. There's, but also, because even when he ran in
for Senate in 2018,
against Louis Vukmir, wasn't that... He didn't take the high ground in that one either.
Right. So that's the text. And okay, fine. The subtext to me, there's a couple different things going on here. Number one, he clearly viewed his path to victory as getting the Trump endorsement. And there was no way that Donald Trump was ever going to endorse an insider like Rebecca Clayfish, you know, a Scott Walker acolyte. You know, Walker was the first sort of beast that Trump slayed in the primaries in 2016. It wasn't going to happen. She went down there and asked for it just like the rest of them. But once Nicholson didn't get the Trump endorsement, once Michaels, another sort of outsider or somebody able to make that case, got in the race, there was no path for Nicholson to win, even though he had a $10 million super PAC from the Ulines. That's one of the more surprising things. People drop out of races statewide all the time. This might be the first time that somebody with a 8-figure super PAC willing to spend on their behalf called it quits before the votes were even counted because he realized he couldn't win. Like, $10 million is a lot of money.
And do you think Dick Uline was like, yeah, I'm cutting you off, this isn't going anywhere? Or do you, because who, I mean, I, this is where my brain, my eyes just glaze over when it comes to numbers that are so monumentally big, especially in dollars of like people's wealth. Who's richer, Dick Uline or Tim Michaels? Who has more expendable?
Probably the Ulines.
You think so?
Yeah, I think the Michaels family only owns 3 properties on the East Coast. You know, they've got the condo in Manhattan, they've got the mansion in Connecticut, and I think I read about one other one. So I think the Ulines, if they wanted to have East Coast properties, would certainly be able to afford more of them and probably nicer, bigger places. But that, you know, that's just one man's opinion.
So it was not the expendable funds were there, had the will been there.
Yes. The resources were not going to be the issue. I think the issue was probably he knew that it was going to be really unlikely that he won the primary. And the only way to do it was going to have to go scorched earth. And between the people funding his campaign and himself and looking at all of the polling and the writing on the wall, and frankly, the fact that Nicholson is a young guy and desperately wants to be an elected official someday, there is a once in a while pulled out move in politics to say, you know what, I'm going to get out before it's over. I'm going to bank some goodwill and run down the line. Conservatives, activists, people will appreciate the fact that I stepped aside when it wasn't my turn, and maybe later on it will be my turn. So I think that's a factor. I think there's also a sort of, if you go on the ballot and lose twice in a primary, because he lost to Vukmir 4 years ago, and if you were to lose again, that's kind of it. This way he gets to say in the future, well, I didn't lose. I stepped aside, for the good of the party, because I didn't want to break the Ronald Reagan commandment and criticize other Republicans, which is, of course, nonsense, because he was criticizing Republicans every day he was in the race. But he'll say that with a straight face 2, 4, 6, 8, 12, you name it, years from now. It's going to be a long time before Kevin Nicholson is done with our politics. Yeah. That I can promise you.
So who does this help?
That's a harder question for me. Like, I think there's probably the easy answer is, well, he's an outsider. Michaels is an outsider. So it probably helps Michaels. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's that cut and dried. The Republican Party is really sort of divided in on itself in a post-Trump world, right? Listen, Michaels has the Trump endorsement. Clayfish wanted it. They are both very, very conservative on issue after issue, whether it is reproductive health care, whether it is on you know, immigration, whether it is on tax policy. These are really, really out of the mainstream conservatives.
But don't you feel like Rebecca probably knows more about all of it? I mean, I'm not saying with her, but she knows, like, I said this yesterday. I just don't get the impression that Michael's would get in there and even know what he is allowed and not allowed to do.
I would like to see Michael's stand before a room full of reporters or even just people and take questions for more than 2 minutes. I don't think he's done that a single time.
He dropped out of the public forum they had last week. So that's the, is it July 20th that they're doing, the 20th or 24th? There's going to be two big debates on TMJ4 in July for both the Democratic Senate primary and the Republican governor primary. And is that going to be the first time we actually hear him answer questions instead of just having sound bites?
Is he going to show up? I don't know if he's confirmed, right? Like, I worked for in 2013 and 2014, an outsider candidate who was running for governor, Mary Burke. She was the Democratic nominee, first woman ever to run on a major party ticket for governor in Wisconsin. And it takes time to, you know, and she had some government experience because she had been the Secretary of Commerce under former Governor Jim Doyle. It takes a little time to get used to, you know, this is what I need to know. This is what I can say. This is what's, you know, allowable. This is what I need the legislature for. This is an agency move. Just the vernacular of our politics is pretty tough when you're coming in cold from the outside like Tim Michaels is. So he may not be ready for prime time yet. We're going to find out.
Yeah, and you know, and I say that because it's not like I'm saying that he's not smart. It's just it's a different wealth of knowledge that if you've never done anything in government, you got to learn. And to step into a top job.
Maybe he just woke up one day and decided, I want to be governor. I'm a white guy. I'm rich. I got a lot of money. Let's go do this thing.
All right. Well, we're going to go to break. But when we come back, I want to get your opinion on the bigger question about going negative in campaigns, especially in partisan primaries. And is it good strategy, bad strategy? Good for the individual, bad for the collective, and all of that jazz. But I am here with Joe Zepecki as my guest co-host on As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. And we'll see you after the break.
Can't wait. Kick this thing, but I really don't know when that might be cause. My heart's got a memory. My heart's got a memory.
Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. I am here with Joe Zepecki as my my co-host for the day. And so we were talking about Kevin Nicholson has dropped out of the gubernatorial primary for whoever will end up running on the Republican ticket against Governor Evers. And the reason he listed, whether it's true or not.
The text, not the subtext.
Yes, the text, not the subtext, is that he thought his only line of sight to a victory in the primary was by going scorched earth negative towards the other candidates, which was interesting because that was the same reason Michaels gave to why he didn't want to go to the public forum because he's a builder. And I don't want to tear things down. I want to build them. And so taking it away from this specific case, because I think it's been summed up so far that the Republican campaign, primary campaigns have been uglier
than
the Democratic Senate campaigns. Yeah. And so like over there, really the only person who's throwing any elbows is Tom Nelson. Mm-hmm. And so I think often as voters, we don't want them to go negative. We say we don't want candidates to go negative. We want you to give us something to vote for instead of just someone to vote against. That's not how it ever ends up working. Yeah. But it's also different in the primary situation because ultimately you tear each other down and then someone wins and then you kind of got to rally behind that person. So I guess from the strategist purview, which is you, not me. I just have opinions. What is the calculus behind going dirty versus giving someone something to vote for on the candidate level, but then also how does that translate to what's good for the party?
So I think where I'll start is it's not dirty if it's done right. Primaries and, you know, campaigns that have contrast messaging can be really clarifying for voters, right? So in a three-way, four-way with Rampton primary, where all four Republican candidates, you know, falsely believe the 2020 election was rigged. They all love Donald Trump. They all, are against women's rights. They, you know, want to make it harder to vote. Like when on all of the issues, they're in the same place. It's really hard to clarify for voters what the difference is. It becomes a contest about personality rather than an actual difference. Now, you can also imagine a Republican primary that has like a Liz Cheney or an Adam Kinzinger, somebody who says our democracy is more important than our partisan positions, and somebody like Lindsey Graham, who is a little bit of a chameleon, and sometimes he doesn't like Donald Trump, and sometimes he does, right? And then somebody like Ted Cruz, who is really, really conservative, and he was before Trump, and he will be after. In that type of primary, where there are actual differences on like actual questions, going negative could be, you know, the Cheney campaign saying it is unacceptable as Republicans for us to refuse to accept the results of a safe, secure, fair, and free election. Is that being negative about the election deniers? No, it's stating facts and it's clarifying for voters what the difference is before voters go and make a choice, right? So not all like negative campaigning has to be sullied with the word dirty, because it's not all dirty. Sometimes it's really important. In a Democratic primary, if you had a candidate who was for, you know, single payer Medicare for all, and a candidate who is for, I don't want to go to single payer, let's build on Obamacare, let's strengthen the exchange. That's a policy difference about a really important, you know, topic in people's lives. It's not negative or nasty to point that out. It's clarifying for voters. And so I think that's one of the things that's getting lost in our politics, is it's so much about the food fight. It's so much about the game that you rarely actually see contrastive messaging that is on the guts of the issue. It is more about personality. It is more about, you know, the tone, and that's not healthy and it's not good. So whether it's the Republican, I mean, the Republicans can do what they want to do. If they want to tear each other apart limb from limb between now and August 9th, that's good by me. I would prefer that the Democratic candidates for the U.S. Senate not do that. And I don't think there's really reason to do that, because I don't think there's a huge difference on the issues five leading candidates who are going to be on the debate stage.
Was going to be my question, because I think I pay attention. I mean, I certainly would not compare myself to some of the people like Bill Glauber and the people who are actually writing about this every single day. And I am acquaintances/friends with at least three out of the five leading contenders. I have their numbers in my phone, right? But I also, besides their personalities, and besides maybe Stephen Alacara, who's really running on a reforming government, civility platform, and not a anti-Ron Johnson platform, I don't know if they have really differentiated themselves enough to the layperson.
That's probably fair. And that's the job of the debates and of these campaigns, is to, in the remaining 5 weeks, say, this is what I believe. This is my vision of what I want to do as a United States senator. And really, when candidates are kind of in the same place on the issues, to say, this is what my priority is going to be. Olakara is saying, my priority will be fixing the systems so they work better and we get better results. You know, Nelson is probably the most, you know, has been really good about being clear. He's going to go and fight for workers. Barnes is out there saying it's all about rebuilding the middle class and strengthening the middle class. You know, Godlewski has really done a nice job of talking about the differences between she and Johnson. I'm not sure she has made the best proactive case yet. There's time, but that's the job. And there's a way to do that without being like nasty or negative or
bringing up past human mistakes.
Well, and some of that stuff is fair game,
yeah.
right? But there's a way to do it that just, you know, is less like catty and like awful. And I just, you know, I don't mind negative campaigning. I mind performative nonsense. And some of what we're seeing as this campaign gets chippy in the closing weeks is kind of performative nonsense. And it's, let's avoid that. Let's stick to the issues and the priorities.
All right. When we come back, we're going to talk about an incompetent circus.
So much for not going negative, huh?
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. We'll see you in a minute. Kristen Bry, my guest co-host for today, my first guest co-host, first of many appearances, I hope, is Democratic strategist.
We'll see how the debate
whatever
goes.
Whatever that means. Joseph Hecke, yes. So, I found two stories.
Real quick, before the break, we were talking about Corruptible.
You found
a
the
book
author.
About leadership. Yes. The author, it's Corruptible, Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us by Brian Klass with two A's, K-L-A-A-S. Check it out. It's fantastic. One of my favorite books I read last year.
All right. There you go. Good. That's a solid, solid endorsement. All right. So I found two Wisconsin golf course stories that I think pretty much sum up the debate around golf courses. So one came out yesterday in the Wisconsin Rapids Tribune. Shout out to Wisconsin Rapids by Caitlin Schuda, who wrote a very positive article about the Sand Valley Golf Resort and how what the positive impact on the local economy has been with the success of this beautiful golf course in the middle of the state. It's great. My parents still live in Wisconsin Rapids, was a town that thrived off of the paper mill no longer there. So finding other ways to revive that economy, very good thing. So that's on the positive side, right? And then seemingly, depending on where you fall on this, a negative story is that last week, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled that the conservation group that was trying to block a land swap with the DNR giving land to Kohler Company to build another golf course, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled that they had no legal standing to block that. And so I just feel like those two stories, especially coming out on the heels of each other, of two very successful golf courses that are, on one hand, bringing lots of economy, like economic booms to those areas that otherwise are not the central economic engines of the state. But on the other side, golf courses are not good for the environment. And there's people who are like, we don't need another golf course. There's a lot of other things we could use that land for. And so as we talked about prepping for the day, let's have a debate.
It's about to go down.
Let's have a debate. Golf courses, good or bad? And Zepecki, which side are you going to take?
I am pro golf courses.
You're
pro
golf course.
You want to talk about power corrupting? You gave me a microphone and turned on a switch and people can hear me. Golf courses, the good far outweighs the bad.
Wow. Bold opening statement. To quote some obscure 1903 book about lawn tennis, quote, golf is a good walk spoiled.
Yeah, but it's a walk. So let's get into this, right?
All right.
So here's my first argument. You alluded to it. The economic opportunity that it creates is fantastic. And this is not just economic opportunity for the guy at the top or gal at the top who owns the golf course. As you are seeing with Sand Valley, it is the indirect economic opportunity it creates that is revitalizing that part of the state. You've got, you know, fishing guides who, when people come to play Sand Valley, also want to go out on the lake and go fishing. So it's good for other recreation industry. It's there's bars and restaurants, there's Airbnbs and Vrbos and hotel developments, and all of those places employ people, whether it's the high school kids or the college kids home from summer or the people who live in the town year round because that's home and they don't want to go anywhere. It creates economic opportunity that lifts all boats. And particularly when we talk about the number of ways that rural communities in Wisconsin are taking it on the chin, for anybody to say, no, golf courses are bad, like, you are literally ripping economic opportunity away from people, and I will not stand for it in this debate.
Understood.
Now who's coming in hot?
Coming in hot. I just have to say, there's over 2 million acres of U.S. land dedicated to golf courses. And I understand that there is an economic boost to the development of these plots of greenery. But let me just throw out some numbers for you, because I did research.
Oh, boy.
All right. How bad it is for the environment, right? U.S. golf course, like, the amount of water for U.S. golf courses is 2.08 billion liters of water per day. Per day. That is 315,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools per day of how much water it takes to water golf courses in America. Not only that, but it takes the amount of fuel to run the lawnmowers to mow the greenery, the amount of pesticides and fertilizers that get on the runoff. There's over 300 million golf balls in the ocean. And that doesn't even consider what it takes to actually create, that's just the upkeep. To actually create the golf course is to displace whatever was there before there was a golf course there. So it's either deforestation, so you're chopping down whatever natural habitat was there. It's either dislocating people because there was either houses there, or it's just like disrupting the natural habitat that was there. Also, you, my friend, can swing a stick in Argyle shorts.
Wow. Okay.
But this whole place sucks.
Let's talk about natural habitats. In the last, just this season, I have encountered turtle, deer, and foxes while golfing. They have plenty of room to do what they need to do. And people who play the game of golf are very polite to them and very helpful. Okay. But you're talking about all these big numbers, pie in the sky numbers. Pie in the sky numbers. If we were to stop building golf courses, would all of the other construction and things that we're building in this country cease? Of course not. When you build a golf course, I think you are actually netting a positive for the environment, because you are giving people a place, a place for communities to come together and enjoy the outdoors who otherwise would not. And that enhances their appreciation of nature and the world around
it. That's a big stretch.
How is it a stretch?
Why would they be more likely to use a golf course than like a community park?
Hiking's not for everybody.
Golf's not for everybody.
Exactly, but it's another place that people can come together and have a sense of community and appreciate the outdoors.
Is that so? Well, who made you pope in this dump, huh?
This is Brian with the cash check.
Right, so like, for example, I play in a golf league, and it exposes me to guys who I wouldn't otherwise, you know, work with or see or be friends with. And so it broadens my horizons through a sense of community. And we get to appreciate the fact that most golf courses are built into really interesting terrain. If you have ever stood on the 17th tee box at Hawks View in Lake Geneva and done a 360, you would appreciate all the more how small we all are in this world. And if we can get people outside.
That's what gives you perspective.
It's one of the things. Absolutely. So
just stare at the stars.
I live in an urban environment where the stars aren't as clear. Let me tell you, when I was up north a couple weeks ago, in part to play 27 holes of golf, I did stare up at the sky. But let's get people off screens. Let's get them outside. Let's get them onto a golf course where they can appreciate nature. And like, you're talking about all this water they use. That water goes into the ground, into the watershed, and it comes back, right? We're not losing all of that water. It's not like we use it and lose it. It returns back.
I just am not convinced that there's enough people to like and appreciate golf to warrant how many golf courses there are and how many more there is a desire to build. Like, the actual amount of regular golfers in the United States, I don't think is a big a very large amount. And so when you think about a place like Los Angeles, where there are basically very few public parks, but lots of golf courses, you're gatekeeping this green nature area that you say is so, you know, beneficial to a bunch of people if they were just to use it. That's putting the burden on them and gatekeeping them from like actual outdoor areas that could be used for something that is more diversified in the activities to be done there.
Listen, Hollywood, we're not talking about Los Angeles. We're talking about Wisconsin. We're talking about rural communities that have been hit and there's less economic opportunity available. We're talking about, you know, a place where people can get outside and have a sense of community. And we're talking about, like with everything else, progress by humanity. You're sitting here talking about, well, all the gas it takes to, like, you know, run the lawnmower. You know what? Just like everywhere else, golf courses are evolving. They're transitioning from gas-powered carts to electric carts. They're, you know, learning more about water conservation and best practices all the time. They are, you know, creating opportunities for wildlife and for native plants to grow that wouldn't otherwise be there. One of the things you got to understand is, like, and you know this, like, you play golf. Most of these golf courses are, like, carved into developments, housing developments, that if it weren't for the golf course, would just be more houses.
So if we're going to take this whole progress side, are you, is that the same argument you're going to say when I bring up the fact that golf is historically a racist, classist, sexist sport?
It 1,000,000% is. And in our lifetime, it has become more accessible to more people, in no small part due to people like Tiger Woods, who have broadened the game. It's become more of a global game. You see, you know,
it was always a global game because it was like it was basically spread through colonialism as a when you talk about unification, it was basically a European way to spread unity across the European colonies. It's like, oh, here's some golf.
Well, but now you see players from Asia competing in Europe and in America and around the world. And let's not lose sight of the fact that golf also does bring the world together. Right. When you talk about the Ryder Cup, we had a successful one here at Whistling just last year, 2 years ago. I don't know what time is anymore.
But September. I went. Did you go?
No. Mm. God, that was, what, 9 months ago?
I don't know.
Oh, man.
Keep going.
But it brings the world together in ways that are uncommon and I think are still valuable.
I think that, and I just think that there are other ways to do that and that we don't need more golf courses. I think that there are enough golf courses to do exactly what you are saying are the benefits from it. I'm not saying we have to abolish golf courses. I'm saying we may not need more of them for all the reasons I said. And if at that point, I'm going to end. And to the audience, who won the debate? Yeah. We would love to hear.
Well, two questions. What do they think? And number two, why did I win the debate?
No. What do you think first? But also, who won the debate? Did we change your mind? Did you start this conversation thinking something else, and did we change your mind? Give us a call, 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-PARTY. This is As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry and Joe Zepecki.
Cuts like the knives are new.
So I got that going for me, which is nice.
All right, I think you're converting me a little bit. This music's been pretty good so far.
Certainly converting you to anyone who wants to sit across from you has to come prepared with the music.
Yes, I now have to tell everyone who ever comes here is like, well, you got to pick the music and see if it's any better than Zepecki's music. Welcome back to As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. I am here with Joe Zepecki, and we just...
I just dominated you.
I don't know if you dominated
me. I crushed that argument.
Yeah, I think you have more practice. I was on speech and debate team for 2 years in community college. I did win a couple gold medals, but only at like the entry level.
That's 2 more years experience than I had.
Really? You never did debate club?
That's self-taught. I was too much of a jock. I was too busy playing football and basketball baseball.
Fair enough. All right. Well, for anyone who did hear our debate on golf courses and whether or not more of them are a good thing, let us know what you think and who won. But right now we have Mark from Prairie du Sac. Mark, who do you think won?
Hey, yeah, I think
I don't know if we have enough golf courses or not. I used to tease my dad that the only thing worse than watching golf on television is playing the damn sport. And I used to golf when I was, you know, younger all the time. I was actually in a league for a couple of summers up in far northern Wisconsin, up in Douglas County, at the Patterson Park Golf Course. Golf courses are fine as long as they've gotten a lot better. But, I mean, I'm concerned about the use of pesticides and the runoff indoor streams, and that and the impact of the pesticides, drifting, into neighboring properties, and pesticides and herbicides, because they're likely using both, and that, like Joe said, that they are, becoming more environmentally conscious, but maybe they should be using, different grasses, and because interesting article in Pheasants Forever on how grasslands could actually capture a lot of carbon, because in some of our grass species that there's, multiples of feet below the ground that the plants actually have in the root system that can actually sequester carbon, but maybe that's too much to ask for a golf course to do, to try to find some hybrids of grass to put in, and rather than the well-manicured golf course that we see the pros golf on, rather than the kind of the rough golf course I grew up, golfing on, because some of the golf courses you see on television, it looks like the fairways are more like the greens that, mm-hmm. I grew up, mm-hmm. Putting on.
Yeah.
That how much wildland are we going to convert into golf courses?
So, Mark, it seems like you agree with me more than Joe. So I'm going to go out of all the very impressive facts I think that you threw out, probably more than I even had. It sounds like you think, no, we don't need more golf courses.
Is there demand for more golf courses? Or is it, the industry itself saying we're going to, the whole supply side economics, has that gotten into the golf now? So, we'll create more golf courses if we build it, they will come. Well, not necessarily. I mean, it's in the massive area that golf courses, the footprint that they take up, is that worth the trade-off environmentally that might be going on? And there's enough golf courses out there right now. I mean, I think, but perhaps I'm wrong. Maybe maybe there's more and more people that are taking up the sport. But is it a thing where let's throw a golf course in here and throw a couple tournaments a year but is that going to be a benefit to the public in general?
Yeah. Well, I think the Sand Valley story takeaways include the fact that, like, clearly there's an interest.
Yeah.
Right. And so, like, the demand is still there and still growing.
It's hard to get in there.
Yeah.
Right. So, like, I think there is a demand as far as getting a tee time.
Yeah.
On those courses is, like, it's hard. And so there's a lot of people who want to golf there.
And the last couple of years has changed us. And changed in ways we will not understand for a long time. I don't have numbers on this, but I certainly would not be surprised to learn that during the pandemic, the number of rounds of golf played increased, or that the number of people who took up the game
increased.
Yeah,
it was one of the few things you could actually do.
Exactly. It's one of the first things I did during the pandemic. Yeah. We locked down in March, and then by April or May of 2020, we had figured out how to, work with the courses in our league to, like, have separate carts and, have guys walk and, like, make sure that we could all be safe. So, I think the demand is still growing. And we made the argument as heated as we could. Yeah. I think the reality is probably somewhere in the middle, like most things, which is, we need better golf courses. There are improvements that can be made to existing golf courses to make them more, eco-friendly. And, we shouldn't say, no, we're setting an artificial cap on the number of golf courses. But if we want to make sure that any future developments, can have all those positives that I talked about while guarding against some of the negatives that you and your ally, your ringer in from the bench on this debate,
I totally
Mark,
planted him.
I think there's probably a common ground, as there should be on most things.
As there should be on most things. And I think that, because I will say, as we were trying to decide, I have played golf. I have lots of golfers in my family. I'm not super anti-golf. golf. This is not the hill I would die on, but it made it for a little bit more fun of a debate. And I learned some things while researching my side. But I do think there is a question around how many people benefit from it versus it being still considered something that is for a smaller portion of the population of who actually chooses and has access to and has had lessons for, and the expense of getting your own clubs. And, you know, it's not a open court basketball at a park where all you need is a ball and you can go play. It is something that requires a little bit more of an investment. And so to take up so much land for so few people to actually enjoy it, is that the trade-off that we want? Or is there other ways to increase a local economy besides a destination golf course, I think is the question.
Yeah, among the questions. And we didn't even get into the real fun stuff, which is how golf intersects with our politics.
You know, or business.
When you look at, well, the LIV Tour, this Saudi Arabia endeavor is something that maybe we can come back to in a future debate.
A future debate.
Is that? Maybe I can finally beat you one of these times.
I don't know. That was pretty good.
A 1-0 decision. I got shut out.
You just needed another caller. My dad probably could have called and backed you up.
Mr. Bray, come on. If he's listening. Not too late.
All right. When we come back. Conservative talk show radio host spreading lies? No. Not. Couldn't be. All right, this is As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry with my co-host, Joe Specky.
Here come boys. They've opened doors. Count us off now, Craig.
Because I'm going to be working for you. I'm not going to have time to go play golf. Believe me.
Still Eric Church.
Still Eric Church. This is a lot of... Maybe I'll listen to this on the way home now. Welcome back. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry and my friend Joe Zepecki. Last half hour of the show, and I had sent... Well, this was actually sent to me yesterday by a dear friend, Louis Friedland, who is a recently retired professor of journalism at UW-Madison, and who was actually quoted in this article, which is maybe why he knew it was happening. But there is a New York Times article that was published yesterday with this headline: on conservative radio, misleading message is clear. Democrats cheat. Election fraud claims from 2020 are widespread on talk radio, contributing to the belief that the midterm results cannot be trusted. And so the investigation of this basically found that the mentions of Democrats cheating and similar ideas to that were raised more than 5,000 times on syndicated radio shows and local broadcasts this year alone. And yes, WISN is on there. I couldn't tell who. I don't listen to that station enough to know who it is. But I think, Brian, do we have the clip that was featured in the New York Times article?
Just give me 1 second. All right. Have it right here.
I mean, it was either O'Donnell or Belling, right?
Or Jay Weber, right?
Oh, right, yeah.
Because it's a guy. It's not Vicky McKenna. But it was. I think it's one of the three. And so okay.
If the legislature is refusing to take on somebody and confirm somebody in this case.
Well.
No, Brian can't find it. Anyways.
Tune in next week.
It was interesting because I thought, you know, one of the points that I thought was of why it's allowed to fester on radio, and we say this right now as we're on radio, is when it's on cable news or social media or even local news. You know, there's a video broadcast of it that is easier to capture and easier to even know that it happened so that someone can go out and fact check it.
Yeah.
You know, how many times has John Oliver done an entire episode just tearing down everything Tucker Carlson's ever said, right? Or The Daily Show or whatever. And but so often with the radio show hosts, it's they say something, and they have to fill a lot of time, as I'm quickly learning, right? You know, three hours a day is like you have to just talk to the microphone and keep talking. And there's not a ton of accountability of what you're saying if it's true. And then you get into the echo chamber of you're talking to the people who are listening to you because likely they already agree with you. And then those are the people that are calling in who say that how much they agree with you. And so then you're giving your audience what they want. And it's just this cycle. And Wisconsin is not immune to that, right? Which is why...
Not only not immune to it, one of the worst in the country. And from the other standpoint, one of the best places in the country for conservative talk radio. You know, I don't think it's what it used to be. But I think if you look particularly at sort of the turn of the 21st century, you know, the heyday of Charlie Sykes, that the talk radio had an enormous amount of power. And really up through 2016, I mean, it was conservative talk radio in Wisconsin, remember, that delivered
Ted Cruz's
victory in the Republican primary for president.
Because that was Charlie Sykes' guy.
Right. Well, all of them. None of the conservative talk radio hosts in Wisconsin were on the Trump train until he became the nominee. In fact, the Stop Trump train had its sort of last big stand in Wisconsin thanks to conservative talk radio, where they lifted Ted Cruz to victory. And now they're all talking about
fascinating. Why do you think Charlie Sykes was the only one to get off that train?
Well,
because now he's on the Bulwark. We were just saying we listen to his podcast a lot, and he's on has his own media company that he has started from. He does it from Mequon.
Well, our shared person we admire and listen to, Tim Miller, has a book out. I've read it. You're listening to it. He's got 9 archetypes or different reasons for why people went along with Trump. Clearly, conservative talk radio hosts in Wisconsin fall into some of them. But I think at the end of the day, it's a business decision.
Yeah.
And, you know, a thing I often tell people is there is nothing more powerful in the world than the human mind. It can convince itself of just about anything.
Speaking of which, we just got a caller that lectured me about the voting irregularities and how we're the ones who are delusional because there was a suitcase underneath the table in Georgia at midnight.
Yep.
I have that clip for you if you need it.
And once you make the decision to believe something, the ability of the mind to reinforce that belief, it works a lot better that way than it does accepting inputs to challenge that belief and evolve that thinking. And I'm also reading a book about the brains right now. It's called The Thousand Brains. It's, again, my nerd is showing.
I was going to say, Jay-Z with the book recommendations.
Yeah. So the point being, conservative talk radio bad, the Shah good. No, it's not quite that simple. You should listen to different points of view and different perspectives. Why I'm so excited that you have been platformed for 2 hours a day and this growing radio network exists is because it gives people a choice, an option to listen to something else. And I'll take, you know, 7 days a week, I'll take somebody who says, I'm going to listen a little bit to, you know, conservative talk radio and a little bit to the Shahs of the world. Give me that person before, nope, I only want to live in the bubble on one side or the other.
Yeah.
Right? And so...
Well, I think that's even more important in Wisconsin because we are such a closely divided electorate that it kind of goes back to what we were talking about before of when Iommi called and said, Democrats just have to play harder. It's, I don't know, maybe I'm just a Pollyanna, but it's, I know where I stand on a lot of things. I'm certainly left of center, if not very left of center, depending on the topic. But I also know that I now have chosen to live in a state where there's a lot of people who don't agree with me. And to have a functioning society, we need more moderation of at least compromise where no one's 100% happy, but at least we get something done. And so to coexist with people who don't agree with you is reality.
Yeah.
And to just only think it's my way or no way.
Well, it's actually even worse now. Like, we need to be able to disagree more agreeably. But among the scariest things that is happening in our political discourse, in my view, right, as bad as all of this talk about, this nonsense about elections being stolen, like, come on, that's all false. It didn't happen. Even more dangerous than that are these ad hominem attacks from the right that would have you believe that Democrats want to destroy this country. I don't know how we come back from that, right? Like there is a thread to follow. Like, if you actually believe that Democrats want to destroy America, number one, you're wrong. Number two, if you believe that, you can rationalize a lot of really bad behavior. And so let me say this really clearly. I don't think Republicans want to destroy America, and I know that Democrats don't want to. So if that should be the price of entry if you want to have, you know, a platform or a position of public trust, you have to be able to understand that even though you see the world a little bit differently than the person across the table from you, it doesn't mean that you're enemies. You can be political opponents without being enemies. We have got to find a way to get back to that, or we are cooked. Whether or not, you know, the select committee comes up with a set of recommendations to figure out how January 6th could never happen again, right? Like, there's some other things going on here that we got to address. And that's one of them, is the tone and tenor of the rhetoric. And I know I am not easy on conservatives. I try to be very tough on Trump Republicans because I think they are very dangerous. And I've never suggested any of them are un-American or don't love this country. And when they do, and would say that about people like me or people of my ilk, I don't know how we come back from that. Happy 4th of July, everybody.
Well, I think it's also the, how do you even go about changing that, right? Is this a media thing? Is this an echo chamber thing? Is this who our leaders are? Is this an education thing? Because we're clearly here. I see it, you know, I see it all the time anecdotally in my comment section, yeah. Right? Like, I have plenty of people who said exactly what you just said, is that all Republicans are bad. And I don't agree with that either, but you know, the sweeping generalizations of the other side all the time that are not helpful, that lack any kind of like nuance at all. But how do you, I'm not going to fight with them in the comments and say, well, not all of them, because there's only 45 characters that I can work with on TikTok.
Yeah. So what I try to do is remind people that there's always been really, really heated discourse in this country. And, you know, we say, oh, it's so bad and it's worse. No, it's not. This country has always been defined by its political differences, from the days of the founding and the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists to, you know, an actual civil war, you know, fought in the middle of the 19th century to, you know, the New Deal, when a group of financiers and Wall Street, money types in New York planned a march on Washington to execute a citizen's arrest of President Roosevelt for the changes he was making as part of the New Deal, to Harry Truman in 1948 running against a do-nothing Congress. And let me assure you, he used language harsher than do-nothing Congress. So, and then another spasm of political violence in the 60s. And this is a part of who we are. I think the reason it may feel different really comes down to the information environment in which we live. And so what we have to do is be smarter about just acknowledging and understanding that information environment, realizing it's okay to put down the phone, to turn off, not the radio. You got to keep the radio on.
Right? Keep this show
right
on.
Keep the, like, turn the social media off. Right. Don't like take the bait every time. Sometimes you don't have to like answer everything in the heat of the moment. Just take a step back. Take a minute. We've been here before. We'll get through this too.
And that raises something that we don't have time to get into before the break. But that is an interesting balance, because I think on one hand, we talk about needing people to stay more informed. And I know one of the main pillars of everything I've tried to do with As Goes Wisconsin is like, all right, how do you make the super complicated less so? How do you make the super boring more interesting? Because it's stuff that's important. And it's important that people understand the ramifications of some of the very serious, but sometimes nonsensical things that are happening in government that are not as fun as the Kardashians to watch or to pay attention to. But at the same, in the same vein, have an information diet that you're not so over inundated that you're like, the world is ending.
I think that's a great word for it, is diet. Eat a healthier diet, not just of the physical foods for your body. Have a healthier information diet, right? So like, if you're just mainlining Twitter all day, you're doing it wrong, right? Like, if you're just mainlining MSNBC all day, you're probably doing it wrong. If you are listening to a couple of podcasts or radio shows, some from people who you tend to, you know, be aligned with and some who you don't. If you tend to read newspapers, and I mean actual newspapers, not, you know, like Facebook posts.
So here's a good question. Who do you listen to get your balance of conservatives or central or right?
I listen to The Bulwark, and with voices ranging from, you know, Bill Kristol and Charlie Sykes to others that they have on. I try to read, you know, books from authors who, you know, largely history more than like current events. Like, I don't get into the stuff of like, you know.
You didn't read Glenn Beck's book?
No, or the Bill O'Reilly books. That's a little too much. It's a mix, right? And sometimes we watch CNN, and sometimes we watch MSNBC, and sometimes we listen to 620, and sometimes we listen to Pod Save America when we're in the car. You have to mix it up and get those different perspectives. That's how I believe you get to a place where your information diet is a little healthier, and hopefully you have a little bit better perspective on the world and can contribute and add your voice, and that's what I try to do. I've certainly appreciated doing it today. I know we're not quite
there. We only got 1 second left. This just flew by. And so one doesn't leave a ton of time to talk about the last topic, but I wanted to, since we've talked a lot about the Wisconsin Supreme Court today, I think they might have gotten this one right. That's where I stand on the ruling that came down this morning about Crystal Kizer and her right to use a defense in her murdering of her trafficker. So it's a little dark to end the show, but I think there's interesting questions around who gets to use self-defense. All right, when we come back, As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry and Joe Zepecki.
Love this country.
Kind of the joy of Eric Church, who was today's artist. All of these bumpers were Eric Church. It's a little bit southern rock, it's a little bit country, it's a little bit blues, it's a little bit soul.
Yeah.
That's all great.
I dig it. All right. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. Last segment as we round out the last 10 minutes of the show. I wanted to get your thoughts because we Wisconsin Supreme Court talked about them a lot today in general. Their rulings come down, and because we can't agree on a lot of stuff in this state, a lot of things end up getting escalated to them. So they have
a lot of 4-3s.
They have a lot of power. And that I will always come back to this joke because I like it and it's a little edgy. But Hagedorn has a swing kink.
Those are your words.
Those are my words. I just like that joke because it's a play on words. But today, not as consequential politically as the other cases that we've talked about, but the Supreme Court ruled this morning that Crystal Kizer, a Milwaukee woman charged with killing her abuser, may be allowed to invoke in her defense a state law that offers immunity to sex trafficking victims for crimes committed as a direct result of being trafficked. So what does that mean? They did not rule on her criminal case.
Right.
She has yet to have her criminal case even happen if she is found guilty of killing her abuser.
This is like her attorneys wanted to do something and they had to like pause that process because between the judge and the other side, they weren't sure whether the law allowed her attorneys to use that. So they had to kind of hit the pause button and get clarity from the
Supreme Court. So basically it's a defense in the same way that we you know, there's the defense of temporary insanity, mm-hmm. right? So it's not that, but in the same argument, and I didn't realize like you have to get approval to even be able to allowed to use this defense, but that's basically what they were deciding on. And it was a 4-3 decision. So it was still pretty close. And it was actually, I think I have to go back and see. It was
Dallet wrote the majority opinion.
Yeah. It was a surprise. It was a surprise. One of the more conservative judges actually ended up, it was like a flip-flop.
Right.
It wasn't the normal lines of how it came down.
It wasn't usually Hagedorn being the deciding vote.
And I see this as, because they still have to go to trial now, but to at least be able to use the defense, and now a jury will decide whether that defense stands or not. I think they actually made the right call, but I don't know if you disagree with me or not.
So to add just a little bit more context, because I think it's really important, right? This young woman was trafficked by this man that she killed. The murder did not occur as he was trying to move her across state lines or right. Like it wasn't one of those. It was an ongoing situation where she was being trafficked. And at some point she drove to his house, shot him in the head, and burned the house to the ground. Right.
And stole his car.
And so for me, it's pretty grim. It's pretty tough. And the trauma and everything that that person went through, pretty tough. And if you can go through all of, right. And the guilt or innocence of it will be determined by a jury of her peers. I've heard some people describe this to if self-defense can be a Kyle Rittenhouse thing and he can walk free, why can't Crystal Kaiser? I don't think that's the right corollary. To me, this is if when I'm walking out of here afterwards, Brian cold cocks me and knocks me flat on my back.
Oh, you're getting it, buddy.
And then 2 or 3 weeks from now, I get him back. Is that, that's not self-defense. That's right. There's all kinds of different exigencies.
Is the burden then to prove, which will not be able to be proven because the other party is dead, on what the exchange was?
And that's where this gets really complicated. Yeah. And so from the political lens, the way that I look at this is why it's so important that justices and courts have the trust of the public, that they are not political, not politicized, that they're going to make these really tough, really sticky decisions, and that people can live with them.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, particularly in the last few weeks, we've seen an erosion of trust in our institutions, like the U.S. Supreme Court, who made a decision that, I'm no lawyer, but I would say, I took a con law class, and I don't think you had to take one to read that decision and go, what?
Or the collection of decisions.
Right. Yeah, the collection of decisions. Right. So it seemed nakedly partisan and political, and that is one of, right, one of the challenges with it is that now people have less trust in courts as an institution, in judges as an institution, in justice. And we can't have that. We need that bedrock to, I think, make this place work. And so, I'm thankful it wasn't me having to make this particular determination. I'm very grateful I'm not on that jury, because what a heinous, awful, crime. But the beauty of the system is, you look hard enough, you squint, Crystal Kaiser is going to get an opportunity to put her case forward and to be judged by her peers, because that's the way this place works. We have to ensure that everyone can get justice, that there can be accountability both for, victims and the accused, and that balance it feels like it's at risk of being upset. And that's part of why everything feels so awful and tense and people have so much anxiety. We got to figure out a way to, be able to take that step back and breathe a little easier, because there's some dark things going on in this world.
Absolutely. Well, to bring it on a higher note besides that, so we don't end...
That shouldn't be hard.
...end on a really... We should have maybe planted that more in the middle. What other book recommendations, content, what else do you have going on that you think people should be paying attention to, listening to?
I'm back in on Westworld. HBO series adapted from a Michael Crichton novel.
Is it season 4 now?
Season 4.
Wow, I missed season 3.
Skip it. Honestly, don't even watch it. But it's season 4 is back. It's 2 episodes in, and it's really great.
So you don't even need to watch season 3?
I don't think
you can
so.
Just skip to season 4?
You probably should. 3 is really
hard to
watch.
It's a very confusing show. It feels like missing 10 minutes.
Have you ever questioned the nation of your reality?
all the time.
Right. And so, like, if you would like thinking about artificial intelligence and humanity and what makes us human and what defines humanity and how
morals and values and consciousness.
Like, it's not a show you can just like turn on as a nightlight or like doze off in front of. You got to pay attention and then you're going to have about 8,000 questions when you're done. But if you're looking for one of those shows, I recommend Westworld.
All right. Well, Joe Zepecki, where can people find you as we wrap up?
On Twitter at Joe Zepecki, Zepecki, for the occasional snark. Although I try to keep the snark to a minimum and the wisdom to the maximum. Not sure I always live up to that. I also sometimes contribute to Up North News Wisconsin with my analyses on news of the day and all things political. And maybe, just maybe, Kristen will have me back in the future.
Just maybe. You were pretty good. You lightened my load today.
All fun.
Right, Joe Zepecki, thank you so much for being here today on my second show, the second show of As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry. And we'll be back again tomorrow at 12. See you then.
Life finds a way.